Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us today. And we're going to have a very interesting show. Normally, we focus on cash flows and that sort of thing. Today, we're going to be talking about, is there life after retirement? And the subject was inspired by the Foreign Service Journal, which is the very nice magazine of the American Foreign Service Association. And this month's issue, the May 2016 issue, is all about retirement from very different angles. And they allowed Dean Haas to come join us today. Dean is a retired Foreign Service officer, and I'm going to ask him to give his sort of his bona fides, because normally we don't spend too much time on that. But in the case of the Foreign Service, obviously mobility is there. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mike.
What's your background?
Well, I served in the Foreign Service for about 25 years, beginning in 1987. I served as a management officer. That was my career track in the service, although I worked in a variety of places. I spent about half my career here in Washington and about half my career overseas.
Is that normal?
I think by and large, yes. I probably spent a little bit more time in Washington than perhaps the average.
Because I remember somebody saying something about two-thirds of their time was spent overseas. And one thing, I ask where you've been posted, but one thing I've got to ask you about here, it says you were a management cone. That sounds like a Star Trek thing.
Yes, they've changed that term now for some years to career track, but we still use the term cone quite frequently. These are the five different career tracks in the service: management, consular, public diplomacy, political, and economic are the five career tracks.
Is one more likely than the other to lead to an ambassadorship?
The political and economic officers, I think, probably have a larger percentage of the ambassadorships.
Yeah, and I've seen some numbers about career versus political appointees now. Has it changed over the years? Are they getting more political?
I believe,
political appointments, that is.
Yeah, political appointees. By and large, the percentages haven't changed much over the last few years. I do know that there have been some more highly publicized political appointments. However, overall, I think that the percentages have remained about two-thirds to 70% being career appointees.
Okay. Tell us where you've been posted. There's a couple of places here that I thought I knew my geography. I don't even know the country.
Okay. I started my career in Canada, in Ottawa, Canada, where I was a consular and management officer. I then went for 2 years to Adana, Turkey, which is in southern Turkey, nearest to the Syrian and Iraqi borders. And I was there for 2 years during the build-up to the first Gulf War, and then during the first part of the first Gulf War. From Adana, I spent some time in Washington, and then my next overseas assignment was in Bogota, Colombia, for about 2.5 years. And then following some additional time in Washington, I was fortunate enough to be appointed a deputy chief of mission, a deputy ambassador, in Ljubljana, Slovenia, one of the most beautiful countries you'll ever see in the middle of Europe, the first of the Balkan countries to break off from the former Yugoslavia, the first country to break off from the former Yugoslavia back in the day. And then again, after a return to D.C., my final tour was as our consul general, our principal officer in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico.
Well, you've been in some fairly dangerous spots there, Bogota and, of course, Juarez. You had a staff. I wondered if it was a typo. It said you had a staff of nearly 400 there?
Yes. In Ciudad Juarez, there are about 400 people who are employed at the U.S. consulate, because it is a focal point of all immigrant visa processing for Mexicans seeking to immigrate permanently into the U.S. So it is the post. It handles all of those immigrant visas for Mexico, or nearly all of them, as well as non-immigrant visas and American citizen services. And of course, there was and still is quite a significant law enforcement. We liaise a lot with the Mexicans on those issues.
And do you did you deal with American retirement communities in Mexico? I know there are several.
There are several, but Juarez is not one
Absolutely,
of them necessarily.
Yeah.
With its proximity to El Paso, I spent a lot of time working cross-border issues with El Paso, since it's a 10-minute drive across the border.
Yeah. Are there people who live in Mexico but go to school in Texas?
Yes.
That's interesting. What's the deal on that?
The University of Texas at El Paso, whose president, Diana Natalicio, is one of my personal heroes, has been the president of that university since the late 1980s. And early on in her tenure, she sought to have a program in which Mexicans could come across and in limited numbers and take advantage of the resources at UTEP with Texas state tuition being charged. And so I don't know the exact numbers, but that's one of the educational resources that were available in El Paso. And then a number of Mexicans in that region are dual nationals for a variety of reasons. And so they have abilities to cross the border quite easily, obviously, as dual nationals. And some choose to reside in the U.S., some in Mexico, but may well take advantage of education, particularly private education in the U.S.
When I called AFSA and asked if someone could come over and talk about this, they sent a wonderful set of talking points here, and I just wanted to take a look at them. And I wonder, is the Foreign Service Journal, is that available to people online, or do you have to be a member?
Yes, it is available online.
Okay, so anybody could get this May issue. I highly recommend it then, whether you're Foreign Service or not. And one thing we need to explain right off the top here is the Foreign Service is quite different from the Civil Service.
Yes.
In a number of ways. One of them is the, in the Army, we call it the promotion or perish, but it's up or out. How does that work?
Very similar to the military. The Foreign Service is patterned more closely to the military system than to the civil service system. We are competitively promoted in the Foreign Service, and you are reviewed every year, generally nearly every year, by promotion panels who review your file most every year on how many people will be promoted to the next grade. There are some strictly limited numbers. It is competitive, and it is one of the most nerve-wracking processes, I would say, in the Foreign Service.
Well, now, if you're stationed in Bogota and they have these yearly reviews, is there a panel in country?
It's all centralized here in Washington.
Okay.
The cycle for Foreign Service personnel who are tenured in the service is yearly from April 15th to April 14th. And just last week was the big deadline to get all of the events in for the year on May 15th because promotion panels start in the next couple of weeks and go through a big chunk of the summer looking at the files of everyone.
And then at the end of a certain period, I guess in the old days it was posted on a bulletin board. Now you get it by email, but you find out how you did?
Yeah, a cable comes out with the names of those who were promoted.
Okay. And what happens if you're not promoted?
You remain in your grade, and you continue to work hard and strive for the next grade level. Sometimes it can take several years to be promoted grade to grade. It's not uncommon for people to wait 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, depending on where they are in the service and the work that they've done and how they've done it.
I thought it was more like 3 strikes and you're out, just a couple of years, but it can be as long as...
No, you are allowed... I don't have all of the year numbers in front of me, but you are allowed a certain number of years at each grade. And you are allowed... once you're tenured in the Foreign Service, you more or less are guaranteed a 27-year career span prior to ticking out his time in class.
And I guess, too, at some point, if you went a long stretch without being promoted, you might get a message that maybe there were other career avenues to be explored.
Well, there are formal messages that can come to you if you are low-ranked. A small number of people every year are low-ranked, receive those kind of messages, which basically just notify them and give them some guidance as what they might do a bit differently in their career choices.
Okay. And it says here members of the Foreign Service are eligible for volunteer at age 50, provided they have 20 years of service, and that the mandatory retirement age is 65.
That's
correct? Okay.
Yes, everyone in the career Foreign Service must retire at age 65, which is different from the civil service, obviously. However, because of the nature of the profession, the retirement system, I always say, is patterned more after the military as well. And we do have this ability to retire at age 50 with a minimum of 20 years of service, which is what I did.
Okay, and I see here, this is where I came up with that number, 67% of the Foreign Service is overseas at any given, most careers are spent abroad, so that's...
In general, that's, I think, a very valid number.
Well, they make the point here, AFSA makes the point here, that it's more than the cocktail circuit, and what most Americans know about the diplomatic world and the Foreign Service is a series of endless cocktail parties with, you know, George Raft and Ben Affleck and people like that. In fact, it's a lot more than that, and that's a very small part of it, I assume.
It is a small part of it, and it is probably one of the single most frustrating parts of the perception of the job versus the reality of the job. And even those cocktail parties, in quotes, are work events for us. If you're a senior person, an ambassador or a deputy chief of mission, you may be at those kinds of representational events 5, 6, 7 nights a week, representing your country, representing our policies, meeting contacts, engaging with people. So the events are really work-related completely.
I think anybody whose profession has been done by Hollywood, whether it's police, journalists, CSIs, what have you, would sympathize with you guys because they don't.
I think you're right. They tend to get into one lane, and that's the portrayal.
Yeah. Now, Foreign Service is a hazardous occupation.
Yes, it is. We have people, over 25% of members of the Foreign Service have now served in what we call a priority staffing, what are called priority staffing posts, places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, Yemen, those kinds of places. Those are jobs that are 1 year in length generally, and people generally cannot bring family members at all. They certainly cannot bring children. Occasionally a spouse can go.
How does that work then? Lauren Larson, our producer, is giving me the here. We have to take a break. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Dean Hunt, retired Foreign Service officer, spent 24 and a half years in some very interesting places in the world, some of them quite dangerous and exciting to say the least. Before we were so rudely interrupted by a commercial break, I was going to ask you about the fact that I think more than 1,000 people now are stationed in places. I want more than that, mm-hmm. that are just too dangerous to have a family or whatnot. What's the vacation arrangement? What's the rotation arrangement? I mean, mm-hmm. I've known people who were stationed in Iraq and whatnot, and they said you come back a chunk, a drunk, or a hunk. You know, you either spend all your time working out or what have you.
Oh, well, we work really hard now on helping people foster their resilience in those kinds of places and, in fact, in the entire career. With regards to time away from post, particularly in those hard, very, very hardship places, there's a whole different set of R&R options for people. Generally, people get at least 3 serious breaks away from their post in a 1-year tour. And we have to staff the posts with the idea that we need to give people those breaks. And so they're staffed so that there's some compensation for the number of days that people end up not on site. But generally, they spend 80 to 85% of the year, I would say, right there in their jobs on site in these very tough places.
And I guess it works both ways. But I mean, some people would go home and others might meet their family in a midway spot in London.
Yes, I think people choose a lot of different options. And some people are allowed to keep their families at their last post of assignment while serving the tour, and then the family has some stability at that last post of assignment, and then they all move away together after the assignment abroad, the assignment in the super hardship places.
Well, it's become so dangerous in the post 9/11 world to be in the Foreign Service. And I think the AFSA thing here says that, yeah, since 2001, at least 28 people have died in the line of duty overseas. This is
It is a very dangerous profession, much more dangerous than I think most people think, because we serve in so many places and we have to, our work is about getting out. The work of the Foreign Service is about getting out and being as much as we can, learning about the base and promoting U.S. interests and U.S. policies. Bad things can happen anywhere, and that is just something that I think most Foreign Service personnel come to terms with. A lot of thought and effort is put into security of our missions, security of our homes. We have regional security officers at each post. We have Marine security guards at most all posts now to help protect the actual building site. But quite a there's quite a lot of emphasis on the need to be cautious and the need to be aware.
I knew an ambassador's daughter, and she married a Marine guard. talk about interesting insights. They were in stationed in Africa in several places, but they talk about the safe rooms and the Marine guards wear clip-on ties in case somebody grabs them, and they carry revolvers as opposed to automatic weapons, getting the ambassador safe. And it's a world most of us don't ever get a glimpse of.
The security arrangements are something that are very, very important, yes, and something that from the top down everyone needs to pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah. When I was a copy boy at the Washington Post, most of my fellow copy boys, that's not a sexist term, they were copy boys, even the women in those days, but most of the kids were older and wiser than I was, and half of them were waiting to take the bar exam, and half of them were waiting to take the Foreign Service exam, which I understand is one of the toughest anywhere, any place. And we had many, many parties because people would fail usually the first time around, and they'd go for a second chance. But tough.
It is a tough career, and I will make a pitch that anyone interested in joining the Foreign Service, I really urge them to take the exam to be a Foreign Service officer, a Foreign Service generalist. It's given 3 times a year now, I believe. You can register online, and careers.state.gov is the best address to go to for information about employment at the Department of State, Foreign Service, or Civil Service.
Well, I remember reading, I think somewhere, that something between 14,000 and 17,000 people a year take the exam, and there are like 400 slots.
That's very much,
yeah,
in the realm. That's
you can
the
get
percentage.
Better odds with the lottery.
It's very competitive.
Yeah,
yes, it is.
Absolutely.
It's not an easy process.
Yeah.
Because in addition to the written exam and the oral interview processes that we have, there's a need, of course, for security clearance and medical clearances,
sure,
in order to join.
Sure. I notice a heavy emphasis here on the fact that you are a coach, and this little league coach. This is a professional field, right?
Yes, I'm an executive coach now. I do leadership and management training and executive coaching as my post-retirement career. It was a very conscious choice. As I headed towards age 50, I started to realize the things that I really had a passion about working in, and how I loved working with people and finding out what makes them tick and help lead them in ways that would get best performance. And that pointed me in the direction of coaching. I realized a lot of the conversations I was having with the people who I worked with and around were really coaching conversations, which is different from mentoring in that I could give a lot of advice about what you might want to do in the career. But what's so important is asking them the questions, letting them hear themselves talk, letting people connect their own dots. And that's really what coaching.
Now, even with 24 and a half years, which is a long time, but you did not serve the maximum, and you obviously didn't wait until age 65. Why did you leave early, if you will?
I left because I was I was very committed to the organization, and I had had a career in which I had done a number of hard things. While I didn't always serve at the hardest places, I will say that some of my jobs were quite high pressured, and I had to deal with a lot of different issues on the management side in particular. And I realized that I had had colleagues in my career who had left early, who had left at 50, and they had always inspired me. And I had a personal situation in which I don't have children to put through college and the like. And so I really started to focus on doing this probably when I was in my early 40s. I really started to think seriously about it. And I just decided as 50 approached that I was ready to go do other things. I wanted to maintain an attachment to the organization, which I've been able to do. I still work part-time for the State Department as a leadership coach and as a trainer at the Foreign Service Institute, teaching some of our senior people primarily. But I also do private coaching and do other things. And I spend part of my year in California, which is my home. And all of those possibilities and opportunities combined to help me see it was time for me to go do other things.
Well, giving away your age here, but how long have you been retired?
This is my fifth year of retirement.
Okay.
I'm about to turn 55 in July.
Okay. So how is there life after retirement?
Oh, I haven't regretted the decision for one single solitary moment. I am very pleased with it. I was able to take charge of my own choices and decisions when it came to career, and live where I want, and have a life that is very enjoyable yet also has an element of commitment to it that I can really embrace.
Well, even though you've been gone 5 years, nearly five, you obviously still have connections there. You know people, and you're actually working there. What's the mood in the Foreign Service, if that's not an overly broad and stupid question? I mean, you know, given the everything that's going on in the world.
I think that there still is an extraordinary commitment to public service, to representing this country, to serving this nation and its ideals. And it really is an impressive group of people that we have at the State Department, both Foreign Service and Civil Service. It is always amazing to me when I think of some of the truly inspiring leaders with whom I had the opportunity to work and who I still get to engage with very often because of the work that I continue to do. So in general, I think that it's a good mood. It's an optimistic mood. It is a very, very committed set of people because the world has a lot of tough stuff happening in it right now, and they are on the front lines.
And the fact that 14,000 to 17,000 people a year take the test.
Yes.
I got an email last night from an old friend who worked at the Office of Personnel Management. We lost touch, but we used to work very closely together. And he was in the press operation. And he was saying we should get together for lunch. He's doing other things now, but how things have changed. He was referring to the good old days. And thinking back, they have changed so much in the media field, the technology. Now you email people and with a question. You don't call them. You know, talking to another human being seems to be a dying art. What's the difference in the Foreign Service now compared to, say, 10, 15 years ago when you were in? And we have all day.
There's a lot. There's a lot has changed. Technology, it took the State Department longer than we would have liked to kind of get fully into the technology swing. But now it really is in our everyday lives, I think, at the State Department. Again, when I think of the differences between 10 and 15 years ago, it is about the speed of communication. It is about how fast news travels around the world and how for our missions abroad, it's not about reporting the facts. Most of the facts are on TV faster than report them. But it is about the interpretation of those facts or the correction of those facts, because still sometimes media gets it wrong. So I think the focus in general for our missions overseas is to make sure that information is fed back to Washington that is accurate, and that analysis, political, economic, whatever sort of analysis is needed on the ground by those folks is also relayed back as quickly as possible.
So you could be in a post somewhere in touch with Washington, and you could be sending them the actual facts, and they're seeing on television an interpretation of what's going on. That I would think could be a problem.
I would say that's a key job for those of us, for those people who are in the field, is to make sure that that the facts, that the ground truth is relayed. The media very often gets it right, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
However, when there are nuances or when reporting is not perhaps as fulsome as it needs to be, we have a responsibility on the Foreign Service side to fill in the gaps, and then also to talk about what this means for the host government, what it means for our bilateral relationships, whatever it might be.
Well, this 24/7 news cycle causes problems for everybody at some point. I was at a place during the Newtown shootings, and there was a retired government executive with me, two Metropolitan policemen on either side, and we were watching this unfold at the school, and it was live on cable, and I won't say which channel, but which network. But they got every fact wrong. They got every single fact wrong in reporting this. They said the man's brother was with him there in the school. He was not. He was in New Jersey. They said the mother was involved in it. She was home dead. Every single fact they reported, and it just came like that, like lightning. And I can only imagine if you're in a crisis somewhere overseas. Take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Dean Haas. He's a Foreign Service officer who had 24 and a half years in some very interesting spots and some very dangerous spots. And Dean, could I put you on the spot and ask you to tell us some war stories, you know, good times, bad times, ups, downs?
Sure, Mike. I like to preface this kind of a discussion by saying that when I came in from California, I did not know where I really wanted to serve. I didn't really have a geographic area in mind. And they sent me to Canada on my first tour because I really was happy to go. And then I knew I had to do something harder on my second tour because that's what we needed to do. And so bottom line was, when I went to Adana in southern Turkey, I got there 12 days after Saddam invaded Kuwait. And was sent almost immediately to the Iraqi-Turkish border to see if any Americans were able to get out of Iraq because of the situation that was at hand. And I started to realize that while this was dangerous, in quotes, I could do it. And so my motto became, I can do bombs, not bugs. And so I made choices over the years when it was time to do harder jobs that I was fine stepping into places that might be a little bit more dangerous, such as Bogota at the time and Ciudad Juarez at the end of my career. So as far as war stories, I have to preface by saying I don't have stories of danger akin to many of my colleagues who have served in some of these very, very hard places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. I do have a story when I was in Turkey in the early 1990s. We were getting ready for an event outside of the consulate, and we had an explosion at the consulate, and it was a noise bomb. It didn't do a ton of damage. It damaged a car in our parking lot. But I really learned immediately how quickly anything involving U.S. diplomacy makes headlines because CNN was there within minutes in this large town, but southern Turkey, to start reporting on this. And we had to really react. Everyone, fortunately, there were no injuries or anything like that, but we really had to react in this crisis. I can also put out there a story about going to Ciudad Juarez. This is a place that had a very, very difficult time of it, fortunately has come out of the dangerous part of the drug issues there somewhat. But the year I was there, there were 3,000 murders in Ciudad Juarez, and three of those were people affiliated with the consulate. That occurred about 3 months before I arrived. And so I arrived to a place where there were a lot of jitters, as you can imagine. In the Foreign Service, people know what they sign up for. And sometimes they sign up for something and then it changes. And that can be a particularly hard thing for a post to go through. So a place that they might have signed up for that they didn't expect to be quite as dangerous can quite quickly become that. And that's always a difficult transition for post. And then people leave and a new group comes in who have more consciously signed on to danger. And that transition is usually of value to everyone.
You have the State Department, U.S. Information Agency, where my mother worked for many years, and then AID, Agency for International Development. You have Foreign Service officers in all three of those. I used to know someone, and she was a troubleshooter, and she would go to an embassy, and somebody was having marital problems, money problems, that kind of thing, and she settled that. So it is a universe of its own, isn't it?
Well, we are fortunate enough in that the department provides a lot of resources in that regard. Both at posts with the regional medical professionals, as well as the ability for people to take advantages of services that the department offers here in Washington. And fortunately, with the way communication works nowadays, people can find out, can get a lot of information, can get a lot of resources if they might need them. We also have at each post a community liaison officer at most all posts, and that's usually a family member who is hired to help with community activities, including helping family members gain employment, including keeping an eye and an ear attuned to morale and the mood of families and employees in the mission, and also to be an advocate for family issues.
You made the point that civil service is not like the Foreign Service. The Foreign Service is more like the military, promote or perish, up and out, that kind of thing. In order to be able to retire at 50, is it an enhanced system? That is, do people pay more into the retirement fund and then get a larger annuity than the civil service?
I'm afraid that I don't have all of those details, so I really can't comment. I can say that for the Foreign Service system, I don't know that we pay more in. However, we get a certain percentage for every year of service based against our high three. So there are elements to it that are similar to the civil service, but I'm afraid I can't comment
I
too much on specifics.
I don't know them, and I know that there are differences too. There's danger pay or whatever you call it. Talking about danger, we've focused on bombs and bullets and whatnot, but with this Zika thing that's coming soon to a neighborhood near you, it's been cold and rainy here in Washington for May, but this is not the norm. And as soon as it hits, we're going to start having these cases pop up. And I would think you've got tens of thousands of Foreign Service people who are in these very dangerous tropical zones.
Yes, we do. I heard a briefing last week to one of the classes that I'm currently involved with as a trainer, talking about places in Africa and elsewhere where malaria meds are, absolutely required. Some discussion about Zika. Last year we had Ebola. Maybe it's 2 years now. We had Ebola. So these are all things that are on people's mind. And again, information is out there for folks as they choose to request assignments. We bid on assignments. You have to make an individual decision as to where you might like to serve and what conditions work for you if it's time for you to do something harder or more dangerous.
So you can request a place?
There's a bidding system, and I wouldn't say request.
Right. Okay.
Nobody would want me to say request.
Yeah, cool.
People in the service bid on a certain number of jobs each year. If they're transferring the following summer, the previous year they bid on a variety of positions that are going to be available, and then they basically have to use references and the like to get. There's a whole job hiring process that takes place in the Foreign Service side as people shift jobs every 2 or 3 years.
So I guess there are many times where you find yourself competing with your best friend at the office, huh?
Yes, very much so.
How does that work?
Well,
pretty accepting of
this kind of heads a bit into my own personal philosophy about the competitive nature of the business. I believe that it is infinitely more important in the Foreign Service for one to be competitive, mostly with oneself. Your promotions will come if you're doing work that satisfies you, if you're doing work that enriches you, if you're in a place where you feel your family is comfortable or can make do. And let the promotions come, because your work will speak for itself in those situations. And yes, your colleague may be your competitor, but in fact, he or she is your colleague first and foremost. And let's leave it in that place.
Yeah. Okay. You obviously thought about retiring. You said you started thinking about it at 40 or 50. What do you do? How do you prep for retirement?
Well, in my case, one of the hardest things was getting a feel for the numbers. And one of the things that I really made a point of mentioning in my article, and I think this applies both to civil service and Foreign Service personnel, is really look at your pension benefits and the enormous, enormous benefit of having health included in your pension. I have friends who have worked in local government in California who have a huge percentage of their income as their annuity. However, they have to pay their own health insurance, and it decimates that annuity. And federal employees have this great pension benefit with a generous health benefit in addition to the annuity that comes your way. And it's important to kind of annualize that and realize just what a nest egg that is.
Okay, take a short break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Dean Haas. He's a retired Foreign Service officer, 24 and a half years with Uncle Sam in some very interesting spots and some fairly dangerous spots, too. Dean, this month, the May issue of the Foreign Service Journal is exceptionally good for people who are thinking about their benefits and their pay and that sort of thing. And there's a series of articles in here, and I appreciate you coming in to talk about your job and whatnot. What's your article about? And people can get this online, by the way.
My article is entitled Retiring Early and Finding Your Ever After. And it is really about stepping into the possibilities, figuring out that whether you're retiring early at 50, as I did, or at any age, that it really is about what you choose to retire to, and that everyone gets another chance to decide what else might they like to do professionally or personally. One of the recurring phrases that I have in my piece is, what's the dream? You have a chance to kind of decide what's next for you. And I just really want to point people forward and help them to see that a lot is possible, especially when you have the benefit of the annuity and health benefits that come with a federal retirement.
Well, that makes you, you know, it's interesting that you catch the health thing. A lot of federal workers, to me, seem to take it for granted. This is part mm-hmm. of the job, but it's not, not in the private sector.
Not at all.
Obamacare notwithstanding, it is a right. big deal. And if you can go into a second or a third career and say, hey, I've got a security clearance, which is gold. I have health insurance, which is gold. I have a guaranteed retirement indexed more or less to inflation, which is gold. That makes you a very desirable candidate.
It makes you a candidate, and it also helps you with any salary negotiations, because the firm will save enormous amounts in not having to cover you for health in particular.
Yeah, that's a good. Some of the other articles in the journal were talking about the diversity of things that people do afterwards. I mean, they didn't all retire to foreign service type things. One man is he's an instructor in Okinawan form of karate. Somebody else is a volunteer. What have some of your friends done who've taken early retirement?
Some have gone into academia. Some have chosen to live abroad. I was thinking about this coming in this morning, that the Foreign Service, because of the opportunity we have to live overseas, oftentimes people decide that that's where they want to settle, perhaps in a former post of assignment. What I think is great about this issue is that there are somewhat 30 pieces, I believe, about the options. And the great thing is you can choose something that works for you. And there's so much possible that if you are hesitating, it really is about stepping across that line and realizing it's okay. There's a lot more out there.
Is there anything more you could have done to prep for retiring? And is there anything you regret, anything you'd do over if you could?
At this point, I can't say that there's anything that I regret. If I were to give kind of advice or guidance, it would go back to make sure that you're as sure as you can be about your financial situation. And also, here is one piece. This didn't happen to me, but I had a friend who thought she had made a decision about where to retire and had bought property. And this is one of the big no-nos that they teach you in the retirement courses. Don't make a firm decision about the where
rent.
Until after you retire uh-huh. and can make a firm decision. Because if not, you're going to end up, if you end up moving and buying another piece, and in this case, she bought a third property, moved three times, it took a lot of the nest egg away. And so there is a big piece of advice, I think, that is really valid about renting where you think you want to settle and then deciding if it's going to be the permanent place.
Do you have colleagues that actually settled abroad?
Yes. Uh-huh.
But what countries did they go to? And were these countries, were they stationed there, or was this just a dream?
I know someone who retired to France. Uh-huh. Yes, she had worked there at one time, but also had served in Europe a fair amount and had bought a piece of property in France before retirement. I know others who have retired to Mexico. There are many American yeah. communities in Mexico. I know others who have retired in Southeast Asia as well.
Yeah, we hear here at Federal News Radio for some people who are in Panama. They're mm-hmm. you know, expats living there now and whatnot. Well, what advice would you have for somebody who's 25 years old in government, in the Foreign Service, or in the regular civil service?
I will give. this is something that I did actually, because when I was in Juarez, I had 45 officers who were first tour, so they were their first tour in the Foreign Service. And one of the things I liked to mention to them was to recognize the value of the Thrift Savings Plan and to recognize that they have this retirement option at 50. A lot of people, I didn't realize I could retire at 50 till I had been in a few years, to mm-hmm. be quite frank. However, investing in the TSP is a huge plus, and investing the max if you can is You'll never regret it if you have the possibility of doing it. So that's one of the key pieces of advice that I always that I would give to a 25-year-old. And in the Foreign Service or in the State Department, I would recommend rather than looking at the place, because a lot of people want to serve in places, mm-hmm. you need to look at the position, look at the job, look at the career potential in the job, look at how it's going to nourish you, look at how you might have a much better job available to you in Mauritania than you would in Switzerland. And so will you go to Mauritania and do this hard work? Because it can be incredibly rewarding to do that kind of work in a difficult place.
That's interesting. And what you said about the thrift savings plan too, it's so dull and droll and all that, but it's so vitally important, particularly when you're younger. If you put in 5%, you get a 5% match from the government. It's tax-free pay raise, money left on the table. And if you do it early, it has so much more value than if you do it in your 50s.
You got to do it. It can be a little painful at the start, particularly now, given the percentages are so much higher than they once were that you can contribute personally. But if you can do it, I could not more highly recommend it.
Some of my friends, fellow copy boys, those that made it past the Foreign Service exam, a number of them bought homes in the Washington area. Of course, things were cheaper then, as were salaries were lower. But a lot of them served overseas for 20, 30 years. And when they came home, they had a house to come to that someone else, a renter, a tenant, had paid for.
Yeah.
A lot of people do that.
And it is another benefit. If you can make the investment, to have property, particularly in the Washington area, you have another very, very valuable, piece of your retirement plan.
You said something that all of the good retirement counselors that I've heard said, and it's so simple, but it's so true. It's you don't retire from something, you retire to something, mm-hmm. correct?
Right. For me, it also is about knowing when to go. Mm-hmm. And in the Foreign Service, you will be told when you're going, mm-hmm. either at age 65 or when the promotions stop.
Yeah.
And I think what's so important is to point yourself forward and to make those choices for yourself.
Good. Well, Lauren Larson, our producer, is telling us we've got to go. So thank you so much, Dean Haas. We'll see you all here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.